Welcome to Cider Chat. In this episode, it's part 5 of the Building a Cidery series with Soham Bhatt of the Artifact Cider Project. Going up. Hello, my name is Rhea Windcaller, and I am the producer and cider MC of this weekly podcast, where we speak with makers, cider enthusiasts, and folks within the cider trade from around the world. This week's feature with Soham Bhatt was really something for me because I was able to speak to him in person. We met all masked up, so it was quite the interview. So I'm super stoked to share it with you. Whether you are a business owner in the cider trade or not, you're going to find some depth into this interview that I think will really resonate and help you move forward. And also some great tips on equipment. Before we get to that feature chat, we're going to have a wee bit of news out and about in Ciderville. I posted at the Cider Chat Facebook page my daily notes of attending CiderCon 2021. So you could just go to that Facebook page and check it out there. Or you could also go to the show notes for this here episode 259, because I will have the post right on the show notes there. And it's a little bit of my take. I was counting the folks coming in, try to give you a timeline as I was, you know, working out my experience of attending a virtual conference. It's really the first virtual conference I've attended. Of course, like everyone out there, we're all doing these kind of video conferencing, but doing ongoing conference, well, actually, that's not true. I did do one with craft brewers, but this one was so much better because that was via Facebook and they used a different format for CiderCon. So kudos to the organizers. I loved it. And you gotta admit, anybody who listens to Cider Chat was, I hope, tapping your feet right at the get-go. Each day they kicked off CiderCon with We Like Cider, which is the theme song to Cider Chat. And evidently, they also ended the conference too with We Like Cider. So that was just a gasp for me because, of course, I wrote that song and I'm singing on it along with my cousin Jay. And I'll tell you, singing with that guy is just, wow. You know, he and I are really super, super close and we grew up together. And so singing is just like being in the heartbeat together. What can I say? We're in the same sandbox. So that was like a special moment for me. Also, the Fermenting with Quince workshop went on. And for those who didn't get to see it, you will have an opportunity to do that. If you couldn't attend CiderCon, I'm going to be posting that same video of our entire panel discussion to the Cider Chat YouTube channel. And I'll keep you up to date when that actually goes live. I'm going to be holding it back a little bit because, you know, the American Cider Association, they're trying to work with their members. And right now, if you're a member and you signed into CiderCon, you could go back and watch the entire thing from the beginning, as far as I know. So that's the new age that we're living in. But what an opportunity to see folks. It's just, you know, I'm just wrapping my arms around people and giving them virtual hugs. And I really, really dug that. Of note before we move forward is that Soham Bhatt, who is our featured guest on this week's episode, just became elected onto the board of the American Cider Association. So that's cool. And the other key thing is that the association now has a new president, and that would be Eleanor Leger of Eden Specialty Cider. And I know that you've heard me talk about her before if you are a regular listener of Cider Chat, because I just revere this woman. Okay, we could start with the products that Eden makes. It's just, you know, it stops you in your tracks. Quality, customer service all the way. And as a person, she is just a beam of radiant light. I just dig her, you know, yet again. Last week we were talking about Izzy. This week we're talking about Eleanor. You know, it's outstanding to be surrounded by so many cool, wonderful people. She's been a longtime supporter of Cider Chat. She kind of keeps that on the down low. But I'm just thrilled. I'm thrilled for her to really get to see her set of skills that she brings to the table have the ability to really help the association move forward. I have no doubt. Excellent choice. Talk about cider going up. I got a note this Monday from Fermentis telling me that Kevin Lane, who is at the CiderCon trade show, and it's where vendors go live and are able to talk to people in real time, kept on hearing from folks coming in about the Q&A with Fermentis. I loved it. Hey, thank you so much, Ciderville, for letting my sponsors know that you're listening. It means a lot, and that really carries it forward. They're stoked, I'm stoked, and I hope you're stoked too, because we're going to go to another Q&A with Fermentis and hear Kevin Lane talk about whether or not beer yeast or wine yeast is something to use with cider.
Hello, my name is Kevin Lane, and I'm the Technical Sales Support Manager for the Americas for Fermentis. You could use really any yeast for the reason that yeast is yeast, and it's humans that actually apply that name to the different strains. So it's humans that are categorizing the yeast in different ways for specific types of products. Now, you could use a beer yeast, or you could use a wine yeast, or distilling yeast, or any of the different categories of yeast that humans have made. The only thing is that, for one, you're not entirely sure about how that strain will react in the carbohydrate profile of apple juice. And number two, you're not really sure how the flavors produced by a certain yeast strain will impact a cider in one way or another. Now, from experience, I know that we have some customers that are using more or less an English type ale yeast strain to make their cider, or even an American ale type yeast strain. And we also know that cider makers are using some of our wine strains to produce their ciders, and that's fine. It's just that we, as a producer of yeast and as a supplier to the industry, haven't necessarily tested our other product portfolios in the apple juice or apple must environment. So the simple answer is yes, you could use a quote-unquote beer yeast or a quote-unquote wine yeast or any yeast in general. It's just that the outcome in terms of the flavor profile and how that plays with the apple character and also how complete the fermentation is based on the carbohydrate profile, it's unknown to us, and the end users that are making cider with those different strains have obviously, you know, really worked on trials to define their process, define the parameters to have the right sensory profile of their cider with those different strains.
Thanks, Kevin Lane. If you want to find out more about Fermentis and the yeast that they offer specific to cider, go to fermentis.com. It's time now for part 5 of the Building a Cidery series. And this week, we're looking at the workings behind an urban-based cider company who sources juice from the orchard and then ferments on-site in a much more urban landscape. In part 3, we had Courthouse Creek Cider Company based in Virginia, and they have their orchards on site. And then last week, we spoke to Steve Garwood of Ragged Hill Cider Company, again, a cidery that has their orchards based on site. With Artifact Cider Project is a little bit different. They have two different sites, both of which have tasting rooms, one in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and the other in Florence. Whereas Courthouse Creek and Ragged Hill are both orchard-based cideries, Artifact is truly an urban cidery model in that they are sourcing the juice, it's being delivered already pressed to the cidery, and then fermented on site at either the Florence location where the bulk of their product is made, or in smaller batches in Cambridge. Either way you scoop it, it's all a good deal, and they're making quality cider that is obviously resonating with the consumers. Let's all now grab a glass and join this chat with Soham Bhatt of the Artifact Cider Project as he dials us into the history of the business up to today.
These days, at least, you can choose between whether you want to produce it yourself or you want to have somebody else or borrow some equipment or something like that and do it in somebody else's shop. Back then, we didn't really have much of a choice other than to produce it ourselves. The first question was, okay, well, what kind of scale are we looking at? And what are our goals for this initial part of this? We still both had full-time jobs. The first business that either of us had ever started, we weren't ready to just jump right into the full on. So the idea was to figure out a way to do this as a side project and just kind of see how it goes. See how, you know, do people like the cider? Can we actually make this? Can we fulfill orders? Is there a demand for it?
Can I ask you, like, on a side project, you're still working another job?
Yep.
And so it's still kind of a side project for you in a way.
Oh, no, today I'm not, no.
Yeah, today you're not, okay.
No, no,
okay,
I've been full-time for 3 years now.
Okay, all right,
yeah.
Well, great.
Three and a half.
Congratulations.
Yeah. Thanks, yeah.
A little bit belated, but...
Yeah.
But see, this is how I'm trying to catch up.
Yeah.
Like, what advice do you have for somebody, and many people are, doing a side gig and then opening a cidery? I mean, how do you do that life-work balance there?
Being in our late 20s helped. You know, we didn't really, if I had the level of responsibilities I have today, maybe I never would have done it. You know, and I think there was a lot of it, which was just persistence and sacrifice,
yeah.
Which probably looking back, I wouldn't have done that way. But I will say that the way that it used to be in that first year, once we found the space in Springfield, built it out meant it was an auto body garage and like even a hobbyist level auto body garage. It wasn't like, you know, like a really nice garage. It was an actual like basic home garage with a concrete slab floor, no drains or anything. We had, you know, a tap of water, a bathroom, yeah. A sink,
yeah.
You know, in one room, no forklift, nothing, you know, no equipment really. And we used to get a juice by the tote, you know, brought in, not even the tote didn't even enter until the second year. The first year was just one tote would show up in the back of a van. I would pump it from the back of the van into like smaller tanks. It was very, very basic. And what I would do is I would work my full-time job during the days. And then when I needed to drive out, I would drive out after work, probably hang out there until...
And where were you located?
Cambridge.
So you've been in Cambridge this whole time.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I had recently bought a condo, so I was kind of locked in on the real estate there.
All right.
And my girlfriend, now wife, was work downtown, so our life was pretty much there. My job was there in Cambridge,
yeah.
So
yeah, yeah.
You know, which was allowing me to do all of this. You know, we kind of put our own little bits of money together that we had, whatever that was for a, you know, 27-year-old or whatever, and built this little facility, and I'd drive out on nights and weekends. You know, that initial phase while having the job, I mean, it was a struggle in the sense that we were just kind of so new to do any kind of business venture, and even cider making to a certain extent, you know, doing it, starting to scale it up from a hobbyist scale to, you know, starting to get into hundreds of gallons and then thousands of gallons, mm-hmm. is no small endeavor. And there are a lot of mistakes that come along with it. I think the good thing for the two of us was that because we started so small, because we started with our own money and it wasn't like we were looking at
lending,
appeasing an investor or a bank or something, our mistakes were small and they were like a couple $1,000 at a time. Instead of becoming, you know, nowadays a mistake can be a couple $100,000. Mm-hmm. So in the beginning, I was definitely looking at it from a much more industrial perspective because I was coming from an engineering background, working with bioreactors and cultures and things like that. And so a lot of it was focused on words like optimization or, you know, whatever it is. And what I found is that over the years, I've kind of boomeranged out of that. And it became, over the years, it's become a lot less technical and less about control and a lot more about cooperation with the cultures, with mm-hmm. with the varieties, whatever it is, mm-hmm. and trying to coax out what's already there. And I think that there's a certain bit of confidence that you have to have for that. And there's a certain bit of knowledge that you have to have, be able to do that. And mm-hmm. I think the first 3 years was definitely me trying to figure out what my voice as a cider maker mm-hmm. is or was. Mm-hmm. And I think that now I'm starting to get to a point where I have a grasp on what it is that we're about.
Well, and I think that, how many years has that been then?
Seven.
7 years? Well, that's a 7-year cycle.
Yeah.
Perfect. You're right on.
Yeah,
right
put
on.
My 10,000 hours in.
Yeah. Good.
In the beginning, it started out as, okay, let's figure out how to make cider. Let's figure out how to make more cider. Let's figure out who to work with, create relationships. When you're kind of exiting from the hobby stage into the commercial stage, there's definitely also a bit major aspect to wanting to make sure that you're also making something for your customers and making them happy, which can have a totally different meaning than what makes you happy necessarily. There's always a little bit of room for cider as an artist to make some cider, you know, some artistic expressions. And then there's also a large part of it, which is always listening to what that customer might want.
The market is going to bear, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the bottom line when you're commercial. It's about that market piece. Well, you must have seen a change in cider just in the past 7 years in terms of the palate for the drinkers.
Yeah. Yeah. So the very first cider that we ever made, so 30% of a field blend of almost entirely rare and heirloom apples. The other, you know, 70% was Baldwin and Northern Spy. So it's a really nice blend, fermented out completely dry with a combination of lab yeast and wild yeast, bottled and sold. And it's kind of funny to think that, you know, I could probably make a cider like that today that would be a lot more popular than it was when we first put it out there.
I bet.
And there were a handful of people, you know, in the cider community around us who got it, who were encouraging about it.
Right. Because you're in Western Mass, which has a bit of a, a bit of an educational level there on cider.
Absolutely. And that was really encouraging. So it's like, having people on your side, being in your corner, telling you that you know, it's not a complete mistake if people don't like it.
Mm-hmm.
But then also learning that, okay, well, this isn't a hobby. Maybe the mission does become how to constantly work on helping that customer edge towards understanding more about cider. And maybe that means meeting them halfway sometimes, you know, and saying, well, okay, maybe you want something, you know, maybe cider makers really like dry ciders and customers don't yet. Well, maybe there's something in between, off dry.
Yeah.
And slowly and steadily, we can get them to understand why we even like dry ciders. I think if the cider is good and you're proud of whatever it is that you made, these specs don't matter so much. It's about that expression and then finding the occasion that works in, you know, or the food pairing or whatever. It's not necessarily about saying, you know, this is the way. You know, and I think you'll see that with the ciders that we make. But that was definitely that first period of time.
So that's where I kind of lost, you know, like, where's Soham gone? Where's Artifact?
Because
you're in Springfield.
Yep.
And then you kind of disappeared a little bit. Is that right?
Well, so what we did...
Were you doing virtual, like, you know, like, off-site contract cider?
No. We started producing in a new location. We were in Springfield. We had about 1,000 square feet there. We just outgrew that space. So the first year was about 500 gallons. The next year was 5,000. By the time we got to 2015 apples, you know, we're looking at minimum I needed to make over 10,000 gallons that year. And I was like, there's just no way I can do it in this room. And also, there's just no way I can do this while having an additional 3-hour drive involved with every time I need to go sniff a tank.
Yeah.
You know, without any help.
And which we is often. You know,
which is often.
Level.
Yeah. When you start getting start getting to that, it's like not just a one tank that you dote on, it's many.
Soham did the numbers and found that 20% of his time was spent driving back and forth from home to work. The short term solution? Sublet a space from a brewery in Everett, Mass, right outside of Boston. It was still a bare-bones site, but it had bigger tanks. Artifact stayed at that site for 2 years and were able to begin canning their product and hiring help.
And that was kind of the moment where we were like, all right, we've got to kind of settle down somewhere now. And we have enough resources that we can actually try and figure out a way to make a facility that is actually a little bit more tailored to our operation than the situations that we were in before.
I know, you know, one part of Artifact is based in Western Mass. Is that why you are in Florence, Massachusetts, which is Western Massachusetts? Because you're still out in Cambridge, which is, I don't know, hour and a half? I don't know. Amazing.
Yeah, two from here, yep.
Two hours. Yeah. I mean, that's still a hike of, you know, of driving. Why this location here, this area?
Because of the fact that we kind of started in Springfield and we're connected to Western Mass, our apples in the, you know, majority are coming from, you know, the orchards near Pine Hill, mm-hmm. you know, Southern Vermont, Southern, Southwestern, New Hampshire.
A little bit New York too.
Yeah, starting to pull in from New York. But, you know, for the most part, our terroir is this kind of Connecticut River Valley.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, knowing how much we would have to make and feeling connected back to this place mm-hmm. was an important part of like, okay, if we're going to set up some roots somewhere, you know, I think it makes more sense for it to be here than it would on the other side of the state. Just from this perspective of like, our soul and our terroir is here, yeah. but also like from the
supplies.
From logistic and supply,
yeah. Yeah.
you know, it's a lot, it makes a lot more sense to be closer to our sources. We had also decided to start working on a new taproom project and small facility in Cambridge itself. And that was actually
at the same time that you were designing the Florence spot.
Yep. Yep. Yeah, okay. So these two ideas came about around the same time, which was,
wow.
if we can create an experience for people on the eastern side of the state for the kinds of ciders that we're trying to put out there. So it's, you know, let's try and, if the audience is much broader there, you have people that are international that are coming and visiting and in and out. Can we get them to understand cider as a part of the Northeast culture? Can we get mm-hmm. them to understand that in a really direct and hopefully exciting kind of cool way?
Yeah.
As most people scale their cider productions, they generally go down a path of becoming more industrialized. So back to like what we were talking about from the very beginning, I kind of started in this industrial mindset mm-hmm. and now have become much more of like a country bumpkin in the style and approach that I make. It's I feel much more connected to kind of the idea of terroir, of sourcing. And it just happened over the years that was the direction and where my passions and interests went.
Yeah.
And so instead of thinking about this as something industrialized,
mm-hmm.
you know, which is we need mm-hmm. to focus on economies of scale, we need to focus on utilization of space,
mm-hmm.
Time shortens because you want to be able to take that small space mm-hmm. and squeeze the most out of it. And what we decided to do here was actually kind of zag the other way, which was, as we grow, I want to just as a baseline build in time into our cider fermentations in ways that other people at our scale generally don't. I've heard of 3-day, 4-day fermentations, you know,
yeah.
for certain,
yeah.
certain
like beer.
Producers. Yeah,
it
exactly.
Beer.
Just
yeah.
punch it through nutrients, you know, kind of get it through
yeah.
stock juice,
yeah.
whatever.
Yeah.
You know, what we're trying to do here is at the very least, you know, seeing cider in every batch that's at least maybe 2 months old, you know, some even longer than that. Putting in aging in poly tank versus just focusing on stainless steel, you know, as the only source of
so,
tank material.
So can I step back there? Cider that's 2 months old, so that's from start to finish.
At least, yeah.
At least. And so,
yeah.
and just for listeners to know, that's unusual for a modern cidery, like
right,
at that
yeah.
level, because they're kicking it out of, so I'm saying.
Yeah, if you use a commercial yeast,
yeah,
it can
yeah.
take, you know, you can ferment from, let's say, you know, 12 bricks to 0 bricks with a healthy fermentation, even with temperature control, in about 2 weeks.
ISOHAM, with the new facility in Florence, is the estimation for production on track?
It always swaps between being a production problem and then it becomes a sales problem. In the beginning, when we started out, we made so little, it was relatively easy for that to disappear.
Okay.
But then, you know, then it's like, oh, there's all this demand. So now we gotta make more. So making more means, oh, well, I gotta invest in XYZ pieces of equipment. You wanna think a little bit ahead. You don't wanna lock yourself in too small.
Mm-hmm.
So you build in a little extra. So then at that point, it's like, oh, well, I can be making 10,000 if you'd like. And so then it becomes a sales problem. Well, I got to make sure we can
sell that. Yeah,
and then it becomes, well, the sales guy, well, it looks like we might need 20 next year. It's like, well, my equipment only goes to 10.
Yeah.
So then you kind of go back and forth and you alternate. And then, that, you know, there's also the other major and most important aspect of all of this, which is something that if there's any one thing that anybody listening to this takes home is work on your business plan and your business model. Know your model and actually understand it. I think that, you know, it took me as a sciencey person, artistic, creative person to ever even understand the world of money and to understand why it was so important. And it was good to have a business partner who did understand that stuff. You know, and for us, after the first few years, it started, the conversation started becoming, okay, well, how far do we even want to go to overall, like in life? Not necessarily just what's next year look like or what does the next 2 years look like. And for us, the decision, and this is the decision that everybody's gonna have to make, is is your plan to just grow to infinity? Like, I'm just gonna keep going until the market or the world stops telling me that they want it. You know, am I gonna just chase demand forever? Or are you gonna find a level that you want to, that is sustainable as a business? So sustainable means, you know, you're covering your costs. Maybe you have a tiny bit of profit. You know, maybe not necessarily highly profitable, but some profit so that you can cover those extra costs if something happens or whatever. And you can kind of keep that going. And maybe, you know, not necessarily fulfilling all the demand that's out there. You know, I think that there was a time when we, you know, when we started Artifact, that like even the community of entrepreneurs, the mindset was to just think about growing any business that you're working on to infinity. And somewhere along the way, about probably, 3 or 4 years in, maybe three, we said, I don't think we want to grow this to infinity. You know, we want to get to a point where it's sustainable for us, and but also, you know, we can still maintain some of like the mission, the soul, the culture of our company, keep it small. I would like for Artifact, and I think Jake and I both have we do feel this way, which is that it's important to go deeper than broader. We want it to last for a really long time. You know, I say this to people, and it's not marketing bullshit, that like, what does it take to make a 100-year company? You know, does that mean that you necessarily grow too fast? You know, and always kind of in our minds thinking, well, we're contented with that scale that we're at. We'll keep us always focused on the customer, focused on what we're making, the suppliers, whatever, instead of only thinking about like the money aspects of it. So just kind of keeping those things in perspective and trying to make sure that the number one focus is on making sure the cider is really good, making sure that the customers are heard, and not necessarily outgrowing our suppliers.
Knowing what you need right now to be able to be content and viable and quality.
Yeah.
That's really good advice.
It's extremely important.
So let's talk a little bit about equipment and, and just the space. What is the size of the facility here? Like,
So
square footage?
We just added a little bit of extra space. So we're now at about 12,000 square feet altogether.
Was that unplanned extra space?
It's just storage space, yeah.
Okay.
Unplanned extra storage space.
So it happens like that, right?
Yeah.
Isn't, I mean, it's so classic for every startup. You know, you start one place and you got to get bigger. You know? But that is a good problem to have.
Yeah, just some storage space. But yeah, 12,000 square feet.
12,000. With pretty high ceilings here, so you could, you know, add up vertically if you need to.
Yep, 20, I think they're really, they're 27 in some, it's at a at an angle. So at the highest point, it's about 27, at the lowest, about 15, 20.
Yeah.
And so the production, the actual footprint of the, like, cider making, the main cider making area is only about 2,500 square feet. The other half of that is the tap room, and then the rest, everything else is where is storage.
Okay. So you intentionally built in a tap room, tasting room right next to, you know, that kind of like open Western style. I don't know why I consider it Western style, but it's true. Right. This is where we saw it kind of first.
Yeah.
And there right next to the tanks, you have an outdoor area where you could kind of push out in the summer.
Yep.
And warmer months. What size tasting room, like how many people can you fit in there?
About 50.
50?
Yep.
Okay.
50.
And then outside you could probably...
Another 20 or so.
Yep.
The apple juice for Artifact is all pressed on site at the orchards. but I wondered about blending.
There are some ciders that we make which are a little bit more like, let's say, process-oriented. So something like Wild Thing, which is one of our most popular ciders that's out there. It's 100% Macintosh cider that is made in the style of, let's say, Riesling. It's fermented, you know, relatively cleanly. When it hits a certain a level of residual sweetness, we arrest the fermentation. And then through filtration, it's stabilized and then carbonated and packaged that way. You know, so that one is about achieving a certain kind of aromatic profile, a certain balance. It needs to be around this acid level. It needs to be around this sweetness level. So because you have to intervene and arrest it.
Are you measuring all that along the way?
Yep.
Or is that more your taste?
No, that's done by measurement.
Because Wild Things has been out for a while. So
right.
There's
a consistency thing.
Yeah.
And you know, customers have emailed us when the batches have been a little off. So, you know, you have to kind of make sure you're always listening.
Those kind of customers are awesome.
I love it.
On it.
I love it.
That devotion is like priceless. Right
and the saddest thing about it is that the color always goes out of my face because it's like, I knew, you know, but I was hoping that nobody would notice. You know, like sometimes it's like, well, the producer's palate is a little... You know, it's more advanced. It's like,
right.
No, that's not true.
No, isn't that cool though?
Everybody knows.
Look what you're teaching. I love that. It's music to my ears.
I like it too, especially something like that, which has a very particular aromatic profile or fingerprint. You know, Macintosh is in, you know, I could blindfolded tell you if something is Mac. And that's what's unique about that apple. But yeah, so like, you know, that one is much more process oriented. The ones that we make here on site that are blended to taste are usually, so, you know, we made the first few batches, we iterated the first few to kind of land on what the overall flavor profile we were going for was. And then we use the previous batch as a reference and taste it. So what happens is oftentimes those numbers change, the blend percentages are different. But it's about achieving a certain je ne sais quoi essence or vibe to those blends. And so something like Wolf at the Door is blended in a certain kind of way. Magic Hour is blended in a certain kind of way. Even Slowdown, which is another 100% Macintosh cider, because it's a dry Macintosh, to build in some layers of complexity, it can't really be a singular fermentation. So we ferment the Mac juice with different cultures that we have, and then it's blended to achieve a certain kind of complexity or of taste.
All done in like a 2-month period for that? That's pretty something, huh?
Yeah, well, some of it we hold on to longer, and then some of it, you know, so it's like we keep a kind of stock of this. It's a bit like that. And you know, like, so having some that's been sitting on lees for a while to get some of that lees character in there, that becomes a kind of our lees stock, and then we have this, a fruity, you know, more aromatic stock.
Are you stirring in the lees?
We have a mixer that we use for that.
Right on. All right, well, let me ask you this other thing here.
Yeah.
Equipment that, we didn't really need to go there.
There's a kind of minimum level of things that any production facility would need. It took me a while to figure out what that minimum amount of stuff is through a lot of suffering. You know, the tank material is not that important. So I know everybody has an idea, oh, it's got to be steel and whatever. Many, many years we used high-density polyethylene totes. And I know some of the most extraordinary cider makers in the world, even locally, still use these and make, you know, sublime ciders using those. So there's absolutely nothing wrong with poly tote. In fact, I'm so into that material that we have 2,000-3,000 gallon
I see those over there.
Poly tanks because I like what that material does.
Totally.
So material matters very little, but you do need some space and you need the tanks to have a certain amount of fittings on them. And so if it's an IBC, an intermediate bulk container, which is the cube plastic tote,
big square plastic container.
You know, if you get that, invest in putting the correct fittings on there, and you want to make sure that everything is standardized to tri-clamp style fittings. which were actually pioneered in the dairy industry, but are used in any kind of sanitary production environment. Mm-hmm. It's universal. These parts are universal. You can buy them used. You definitely don't want to set yourself off on the wrong foot by having to worry about threaded fittings and, mm-hmm. Or DIN, which is a German standard or European standard. Just, try and make everything according to TCEs. The material of the tank doesn't matter so much, but make sure you have some space.
Stainless steel's way out of their reach. They're gone with the IBC tanks.
Yep.
The square plastic tanks. Just set it up right the first time.
Exactly.
That's it. Exactly. And then they could probably even avoid the stainless, really, for years. I mean, in many ways, it's just kind of for the people in the tasting room to see, oh, cool, look at that stainless. They don't love it like some of us might. But you probably could have gotten away in here with all just big IBC tanks.
Yeah, yeah. I think the thing that stainless buys you is stainless is a reductive environment. Meaning that it's impervious to any kind of air, whereas mm-hmm. Plastic isn't. So mm-hmm. if there's anything that you want to make that really retains its fruit character, and or if you want to do some really long-term aging, or these kinds of like lees projects and things like that, steel can be good for that. Mm-hmm. If you're looking to do any kind of temperature control while you're fermenting,
stainless is good for
that. Steel is good for that because it. Usually you can jacket it, or they come mm-hmm. with built-in jackets mm-hmm. that, if anybody has ever fermented anything over the summer, they know that it can get a little crazy with the temperatures. And, if you're making Saison and you're a brewer, that can be a good thing,
Right, right.
But not necessarily depending on what your goals are with the cider that you're
right.
making. So steel can be a good material. Plastic can be a good material. Wood can be a good material.
Right.
Concrete can be a good material. It all depends on what kinds of ciders you want to make. So don't get too fixated on that to start, mm-hmm. I guess, is what I would say.
Good advice.
Another part is, people think, oh, I need a bright tank so I can chill things and carbonate them and whatever. Honestly, I'm finding that the more and more time goes by, the more and more we're doing bottle conditioning, and we're even starting to do can conditioning. Ciders made that way have a really, really excellent, elegant quality. Which I think is in some ways maybe one of the best expressions of cider. And so if you're focused on carbonation and you don't even need to worry about that, you can just do it the homebrew way, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and add yeast and do a tirage yeah. and do the whole thing. So don't worry about steel so much and that those kinds of bits. But beyond the containers and setting it up the correct way with tri-clamps, investing in some decent hoses that you can do your work with, then the single most important purchase you can make is a pump, a good pump.
Right.
I struggled for years. I bought pumps off the internet. I bought, from like homebrew websites. I'd be spending hours and hours trying to get them to do this or that, or prime, or loses prime in the middle of a transfer. And then, it's the difference between a very powerful centrifugal pump and a medium power impeller pump is about $1,000 or so. Like, you could probably get a centrifugal pump for about $2,000, like a professional commercial centrifugal pump. An impeller pump, you can probably get for around $3,000. That $1,000 is like, you just took 10, you gave yourself 10 years on the end of your life. For the amount of stress that thing will save you.
Good
so
advice.
An impeller pump is probably the workhorse of the cellar. It does everything from cleaning to transfers.
Do you have a particular brand that you like using then?
We have an Inoxpa pump, okay. which is, we bought it. It's an Italian made pump head with, this kind of with a motor on it. And it comes all pre-assembled. But I've also heard good things. There's an American company, I forget what the name of it is, like American Pump Supply or something. Look up American made impeller pump. Mm-hmm. And I've heard some good things about that pump that people really like. So yeah, the brand name, I think just look for a reputable
quality product.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do your research.
Yeah. Do some research.
Get a good one.
Exactly. Get a decent one.
Product.
Good. You shouldn't need to spend more than $3,000 on mm-hmm. it. $3,000 to $3,500 bucks. It's a self-priming pump. so it can pull and push, and so that thing will come in real handy
and easy to clean,
and very easy to clean.
Right.
You can kind of just run sanitizer through it, and you're pretty much good to go.
Perfect.
So honestly, if somebody was like looking to set up a cider facility on the cheap and get started, I would say, you know, first focus on the things that matter, like sourcing, where your apples are coming from, how you're fermenting it. Maybe start with some IBCs you can get secondhand, you know, from either another winery, a cidery. You could buy some refurbished ones on the internet. Mm-hmm. Set yourself up with some tri-clamps and a decent pump. And when it comes time to packaging, just put it in bottles by hand. I know that people don't want to buy bottles right now. I know that everybody wants to do cans. But when you start getting into the can world, that's when you start having to worry about all these other investments.
Mm. And cans are hard to get right now anyways.
Right, yeah, they
and
are.
And that might change, you know, in the next year or so.
Yeah, they are.
Ready to go, but,
exactly. So if you're really excited about making cider and sharing your art with somebody, focus on those things first. And the palette for artisanal 750 ml ciders directly sold through a website is much more than it was 7 years ago. Mm-hmm. You know, you can get away with it being a hobby for a while, mm-hmm, that way. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. So that would be my advice.
It is nice. Yeah, right on.
And then equipment that I don't really care for.
Yes.
Oh, I mean, you know, it's every once in a while you get something that is a lemon, you know, I think that, it really just depends on what kinds of ciders you make. So, you know, I spent years working with a plate and frame filter, you know, because we wanted to filter ciders, and that thing is
a pain in the butt,
in the back, in the arms. It's, you know, it was a necessary evil for where we were, you know, for the size that we were, for what it did. It got me through a couple years.
Okay.
But it was, you know, that thing, I was happy the day that I could see that thing leave, you know, and I could pass it on to another cider maker so that they could go through the same journey.
Learning experience.
Yeah, exactly.
So what did you do instead?
So we ended up, we went from that to a lenticular filter, which is a little bit more user-friendly. You can kind of back flush it a little easier. You don't have to load it every time. It's a little bit more of an investment. A little bit more capability. And then once we kind of outgrew the size of that lenticular filter, we went with a cross flow. So it's a fully automated unit that it filters some of our ciders. Some of them aren't. All of our ciders aren't filtered.
Little, yeah, right.
So some are, some aren't. It just depends on, you know, what we're going for.
So the advice there for somebody starting out building a cidery in terms of filtration, what would you recommend then?
I would say, you know, if you're on that base level of, I've got a tote, some hoses, an impeller pump, and I bottle and I do secondary fermentation in the bottle, I would say, you know, you could just have the luxury of time. Don't even bother with filtering. Let it settle on its own.
Yeah, yeah.
Use a little pectinase.
Yeah.
Just let it do its thing the natural way.
Right, don't worry. Yeah.
You know, we still do that ourselves. If you start getting to the point where you need to filter for some reason, then I would say skip the plate and frame and probably go for a small lenticular mm-hmm. to start. Some people still swear by doing the plate and frame, you know, even at larger scale or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It depends on the goal. I would just say just get a lenticular and mm-hmm. make your life a little easier.
You've given us a lot to think about here, and I'm sure folks starting off, you know, some really good, solid advice. So I really appreciate your time here today, Saum.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm happy to talk about it anytime. If anybody ever wants any information, they can also just reach out to me directly.
These days, all of Artifact Ciders are packaged in cans, so it makes it really easy to grab and go. But if you're lucky enough, you might find some of their specialty ciders, which are packaged in 750ml glass bottles. I happen to have a bottle of their Terra in front of me. This is what's called part of their cellar project. Last night, I had a wine sap. It was absolutely delicious. And during the Fermenting with Quince presentation that we did for CiderCon, I was drinking the Foxwhelp. That was a single varietal cider. And that's a bottle that blew off the cork that I just plugged in there after capping it in the middle of the recording, which is kind of hilarious. Wonderful products. So he's doing a little bit of everything, and you always want to be looking in the back reaches of the cidery, seeing if they have any of those kind of special edition bottles. You will not be disappointed. And with that, I leave you here. This is Rhea Windcaller signing off for now. Looking forward to seeing you in Ciderville.
We like cider, we like palms, we love orchards and having fun. There is a reason.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason why we drink it like this.
Oh yes, there is. There is a reason. We like walking through the orchards, dancing in the streets, smelling all the blossoms, kicking up our feet. We like cider. We like palms, we like orchards, having some fun.
There is a reason. There is a reason why we do it like this. Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason why we drink it like this.
Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason. We like walking through the orchards, dancing in the streets, smelling all the blossoms, kicking up our feet.
Oh yeah.
We like cider.
Oh yes, we do.
We like palms.
Oh yes, we do.
We love orchards, having some fun.
There is a reason.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Ba-da-da-dum.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Ba-da-da-dum.
There is a reason why we drink it like this.
Ba-da-da-dum. Ba-da-da-dum.
We like walking down the orchards, dancing in the streets, smelling all the blossoms, kicking up our feet.
Oh yeah.
We like cider.
Ba-da-da-dum.
We like palms.
Oh yes, we do.
We like orchards, having some fun.
Yeehaw!